the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, and happy Labor Day. I hope you are having a great day with friends and family, and I hope this day is a very meaningful one for you and for yours. Let's look at the fact that this is the 125th anniversary of the first Labor Day held in 1882. Labor activists called for it for a holiday, a day of rest for the working man. And it has become an American institution. It really, in so many ways, now marks the break between summer and the beginning of fall. It's kind of the last big summer event. And all across America today, there are families who have been together or are together or will soon be together for the great American institution of the cookout, the picnic, perhaps some time at the lake, at the pool, just about wherever. For a lot of the country, it's still pretty much a sweltering summer. Whereas already in some parts of the country, you can kind of see the beginnings of fall. It used to be the last holiday before the beginning of school. But right now, across America, about half of all public school students and perhaps even more are now in class before Labor Day. Most colleges and universities begin before Labor Day. And so far as the fall schedule is concerned, a lot of people have been in it already. Labor Day was really about labor activism, as a matter of fact, back in the late 19th century, but Labor Day now is in a very different context. I think it's an important time for us to reflect upon the dignity of work. Now, how should Christians think about Labor Day? Let's think, first of all, about labor. The Bible is very, very clear that the worker is worthy of his hire. You will find in the Bible a very, very positive, affirmative understanding of work and its dignity. And this is very important. Human beings are made in the image of God. A part of what it means to be made in the image of God is the ability to work, to fabricate, to build. We can innovate. We can devise. We can build factories and work in them. We can create things and we can enjoy them. We can plant a crop and we can reap that crop and enjoy the fruit of that crop. All of this is a part of the Bible's understanding of the dignity of labor. A part of what it means for human beings made in the image of God to have from our Creator the gift of work. Now, that gift of work isn't always as much of a pleasure and does not always offer as much fulfillment as we might hope. Why? Because Genesis 3 tells us that work is not only a part of what it means to be made in the image of God, it is also a part of the curse upon sin. After Adam and Eve sinned, God said to Adam that the ground would no longer yield forth its fruit naturally and graciously and generously, but rather Adam and those who follow in his line would have to plow, would have to weed, would have to plant, would have to work in order that the soil would bring forth its fruit. In the same way now, a lot of the work that human beings have to do is difficult work. It's hard work. It's done in hard circumstances. One of the things we need to be thankful for in the year 2007 is that labor is not what it once was, especially here in the United States of America. Labor laws and other improvements have made it so that the workplace is, in many ways, safer. We no longer send children into coal mines, as was the case in Victorian England. We no longer have workers really subjected to many of the dangers that was true in times past. It's not saying that there is no dangerous work to be done today. It is to say that most Americans celebrating Labor Day today are not doing so against the backdrop of likely death at work or of the kind of work that most of our fathers and grandfathers and mothers and foremothers had to do. So what about the dignity of labor? The Bible says that work is an essential part of what it means to be human, both for men and women, both in the outer world and in the domestic world. The Bible says that the one who does the work has the right to enjoy the product of that work. And that's very important, too. And we recognize that there is deep satisfaction in enjoying what we get to do as work. I think for men especially, there is a deep sense of identity that comes from the work we do. And when you get men together, one of the quickest things they get to is what you do, where you work, what's your job. And there's something very, very important about that to a man, something very, very important about that in terms of what it means to be human. We also recognize that not only has God given us the gift of labor, and we ought to see it as a gift, he has given us the ability to enjoy these things, and he has given us the opportunity to use our minds, not only our strength, but our minds, in work as well. Now, as you look at America and you look at the changes over the 20th century into the 21st century, the biggest change is the change from the industrial age to the information age. An amazing number. Millions of Americans work not in factories, but in offices. Increasingly, not even in offices, but online, at home. The amazing thing is that labor has been transformed, but the basic principle still pertains. Dignity of work, but also dignity of leisure. I mean, if it's all about just the dignity of work, you have to wonder how it is that we can take a holiday and have the audacity to name it Labor Day. It honors labor, but leisure is also one of God's gifts. Leisure, we need to be reminded in terms of a biblical conception, is not just wasting time. As a matter of fact, leisure is an important part of human freedom. It's an important part of enjoying what God has given us. Leisure allows us to enjoy looking at a sunset. Leisure allows us to enjoy God's creation. And leisure allows us to take a hike, to go out on the lake. Leisure allows us that family time. It's not just wasted time. Leisure should be time that is used as a stewardship to bring families together, to enjoy things together. I hope that's what you're doing on this Labor Day. I hope that it is a strategic stewardship of your time to maximize your enjoyment of these things to God's glory. I hope it's an opportunity for you to reflect upon the dignity of work. I hope that you're able, even after a holiday like this, to appreciate your work even more. Most Americans these days take a job for granted. Just ask someone who's looking for a job how thankful you should be to have one. Let's remember that we live in a very, very blessed time, in a very, very blessed nation, where there are so many millions and millions of jobs, that right now we are enjoying one of the lowest unemployment rates in the history of humanity. That is something for which we should be thankful. We shouldn't take it for granted. We need to recognize that many people around the world would give almost anything they own and anything they have to be a part of this workforce, to take almost any job anywhere. I want to suggest that something else is important here. In every civilization, there is a hierarchy of jobs that are considered to be more estimable than others. We need to hold to the Christian understanding that every single job has a place. Every single aspect of labor has its own dignity. There is no more dignity to being a lawyer than to being a janitor, to being a doctor than to being a bus driver. All of these things are important to civilization. They are all demonstrations of the dignity of work, and all are to be done, from a Christian worldview perspective, to the glory of God. Now, some of you may be wondering, how can you drive a bus to the glory of God? Well, I guarantee you, the mentality of one who does these things to the glory of God is going to be absolutely different than someone who has no concern for this whatsoever. Every Christian needs to see the workplace as a place of Christian witness, both in terms of how we live and work together with our colleagues and fellow workers, and in how we take opportunity to let people know that the greatest joy we find is, amazingly enough, not in our work, but in our faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Work and leisure are two of God's great gifts. Labor Day is a great opportunity to celebrate these, and really to celebrate the fact that we live in a civilization built on the toil of successive generations who have given themselves. In the age of the farm, in the age of the factory, and now in this digitalized information age, we are building for ourselves and for our children a legacy of labor that should give them a platform for even greater things in the future. Enjoy Labor Day. I hope that as you're having this time with your families, you are also reflecting on how thankful you are for your job, how thankful you are to live in a place where you can create new jobs. It's great to live in a country where you can start a new factory. You can open a new office. You can start your own business. In the entrepreneurial age, it's not just that we face the jobs that are available to us, but the jobs that we create. America is the great engine of economic development, where if you have an idea and you can sell it, you can go into business. If you have a service and someone will buy it, you can go into business. One of the great things to imagine on this Labor Day is how we as Christians should not only be good workers, but we should be good employers as well. Every employer has a responsibility to those whom she or he employs. And on Labor Day, not only is it just a national holiday, it's a day in which we need to reflect upon our stewardship of work, our stewardship of employment, and yes, our stewardship of leisure. You know, finally, we need to remember that even today, while so many are taking a holiday, while so many millions of Americans are enjoying a day off, a day of picnic and all the rest, around you today are people who are very much at work, in hospitals and emergency rooms, in grocery stores and on fire departments. You have people who are at work right now. We live in a 24/7 society. We might be able to take Labor Day off, some of us, maybe even many of us, but the work goes on. Coming up next is a classic conversation on the Albert Mueller program about making the right educational choice for your children. Every single parent faces this choice. Many this year have already made it. This is one of the issues we get asked about most often. How do we look at the options of public school, private school, Christian school, homeschool, and make the right determination? Even as this new school year is beginning, there are people asking that question, and this is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. When we come up next, we'll be dealing with that classic conversation. Because of this, we'll not be taking your phone calls today. We hope you find the show helpful as you enjoy Labor Day. We'll meet you tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Over the last several weeks and months, certainly a lot of parents in this country have been making very critical decisions about the education of their children. Where? How? What? All the major questions that have to do with the fact that we now face a new situation. We better be very honest about this. We face a very new situation. A lot of Christian parents are wondering, should I be sending my children into the public schools? That means many of the things we talk about on this program. The sex education curricula in so many places, the therapeutic curriculum, the moral relativism and other things, the kind of progressivist educational philosophy. All this is deeply rooted in American history and in the role of the public schools. But when I was growing up, I don't think most of the Christian parents in our church gave any thought to this question at all. We just went to public school. That was just the way it was. And there are many, indeed most, Christian kids right now, or the kids of Christian parents, are in the public schools even now. But there has been an exodus from the public schools, demographically speaking, especially of conservatives and especially of Christians, over the last 20 years. There has been an explosion in the homeschooling movement. It's now a major movement that has the attention of the national media. There are of course, many, many private schools. And by the way, one of the things a lot of people don't think about today is that there had to be a lot of legal work done in order to create the kind of momentum for both homeschooling and the private and Christian schooling that now makes these choices possible for us. But as I see it, there are basically four big natural choices. If you're a Christian parent and you're thinking about, say, K through 12, there are basically four big options. First of all, of course, there are the public schools, and that's easy to understand. If you don't make some contrary decision, you're basically making a decision for the public schools. Given the laws of compulsory school education and all the rest, the expectation, the cultural pressure, basically your kids are going to be in the public schools unless you decide otherwise. If you decide otherwise, you have two kinds of private schools. You have non-Christian private schools, kind of in the prep school tradition, and most cities and towns of any size have a school like that. And even many of those schools were actually established with a Christian mission and Christian identity in the beginning, but some of them have lost that. And then you have, as a third option, very clearly identified Christian schools. And again, they run the gamut from those that are very identified, those that are less identified, but nonetheless, they identify themselves in some way or another as a Christian school. And that movement really began to snowball in growth in the 1970s, and now is a major movement as well. And then there's homeschooling. And when I was growing up, I didn't even hear the term. I don't think anyone really thought about it or knew about it. But that was a development that came about very quickly, largely fueled by dissatisfaction with all of the previous options mentioned. But it was driven by something else. Among conservative Christians, it was also driven by the idea that parents must take a direct role in the education of their own children. So you have the intersection of big cultural changes and the real-life decisions that Christian parents are making. I'd love for you to join the conversation today and help us all think this through. A part of the reason we're having this conversation on this topic today is because I was talking to a mother who told me that this is, for her family, one of the biggest decisions they make, and she said no one in their church talks about this. She said, and it's not to say they're not making the decision. She said, we have friends whose kids are in Christian schools and private schools and homeschooling and all the rest, but there's no structured way of having the conversation. Well, there ought to be. Christians ought to be thinking these things through, and we ought to be talking to each other about how we need to make these decisions and encourage each other on what convictions and principles should we make this decision, what kind of information can we bring to the process, and what kind of experience have you had with the options you've chosen. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. And don't think for a minute that there are not people in this country who would like to give the public schools a monopoly so that we don't even have this conversation. And that literature is out there, and it's getting hotter and hotter. We're going to be tracking in coming months the kind of legal work that is now being done both nationally and internationally against homeschooling and against the right of private schools and Christian schools to have a curriculum that's not directly accountable to the state and to the public schools. So we'll be tracking that with you. But right now we're talking about how you, as Christian parents, have made these decisions. And there may be some who right now don't have school-age children, but you have some good ideas that you want to share with Christian parents about what they should be bringing to the equation of answering this question. Homeschool, private school, Christian school, public school, or something in between. How did you make this decision? The phone number, 877-893-8255. Let me throw out just a couple of observations here. And because time is short, I want to just throw these out, thinking that there may be some people out there who would find these of particular interest. Number one, we've learned a lot in recent years about the fact that different children have different styles of learning, and especially boys and girls have different styles. One of the options that goes beyond the simple homeschool, Christian school, private school, public school question is, what about single-sex schools? A lot of people are really giving attention to the need, for instance, boys to learn in the company of other boys without having girls there. And let me just read to you something. This is from Cincinnati Magazine. Cover story this month in the magazine for the community of Cincinnati on the best private high schools. And when it comes to boys' high schools, it says this: besides higher test scores, research has shown that young men in single-sex high schools have greater academic aspirations, better attitudes about school, and greater self-esteem than their co-educated peers. And even more interesting, at all-male schools, boys can explore classes and activities unconstrained by gender stereotypes. A study at the University of Virginia found that boys in all-male schools were more than twice as likely to take art, music, drama, and foreign languages compared to boys who attended co-ed schools. There's a lot behind that. What they're saying is, and there's a fascinating study out of Great Britain that makes the same point, that if boys, very early on, and then in adolescence, see academic stuff as girls' stuff, they won't give themselves to it. If they think that reading is girls' stuff, they don't give themselves to it. But if they can be taught, and sometimes the same sex, single sex, that is to say, educational context really can make this point, if they can see these things as appropriate ambitions for males, they'll go for them. And they'll understand it. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky, where Julie's on the line. Go ahead, Julie.
Hi. I'm a homeschooler in the Louisville area and just was calling to give my 2 cents worth. The fact that we decided to homeschool was something that we felt like the Lord was leading us to do, and just feel like it's a privilege for me to know that I was the one that helped teach my child to read, something that will stay with them forever, and that I'm able to answer questions that they might have along the way, whether it's at Walmart or at the library. The way that I want them answered through our worldview versus a teacher that I might or might know or might agree with or might not agree with.
Yeah, Julie, quick question. Do you think you get the kind of support you need from other Christian parents when you're in this process of homeschooling?
Absolutely. One thing that I was a little nervous about when it was a call to me. The Lord called me to do this. Before I jumped into it with both feet, I did some research, and there are over 600 families in the Louisville area that homeschool. So there's a lot of networks and support kind of things that are out there for kids to get with other kids and do things, as well as support groups for moms to get encouragement from other moms. So absolutely.
Julie, I really appreciate your call. Homeschooling has become one of the most significant demographic changes in the American landscape. And people of the right, left, and in between can't ignore it any longer. And that includes the mainstream educational establishment. The phone number, 877-893-8255. Join the discussion. We'll be right back talking about how Christian parents make educational choices and decisions for their children.
Music. of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. If you rewind history, go back about 50 years, and you talk about Christian schools, most people are going to assume you're talking about Catholic schools, because it was the Catholic Church, especially in the United States, that had this entire network of parochial schools, especially going all the way from elementary and through high school. And, of course, there are still many of those prominent schools that are well-known. But Protestants, and especially evangelicals, really weren't into that at all until the big changes in the public schools. And that began to fuel the growth, massive growth, of the Christian school movement. But, you know, the fact is, if you know much about Catholic school education, parochial school education, most Christian schools aren't coming close to the full kind of cultural impact of those Catholic schools. It was pretty much a full experience, and it really was big in shaping the identity of an entire family. And that was partly because those Catholic schools were also tied to immigrant traditions, Irish, German, etc. But it's also, I think, because they have a long time to think about this. And as evangelicals, we're just kind of in the forward momentum of the first phase of having to think through these big questions. How do you make the decision for your kids? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. In Conyers, Georgia, Larry's on the line. Go ahead, Larry.
Dr. Mueller, how are you?
I'm doing well. Glad to hear from you. How did you make this decision?
Well, we had been involved in our elementary school program with, we have twin daughters, they're 13, and we had always been heavily involved in the school, and when they transitioned into middle school, we walked into a totally different environment, situation. They had never been exposed to the drugs and the gangs and all of those aspects of a middle school, and it was just, a big cultural shock for them.
Now, Larry, I'm going to play devil's advocate for just a moment, and just to make this conversation more interesting, all right? There are people who would turn to you and say, how in the world are you preparing your girls for life in a real world if in middle school you cut and run when you see that kind of problem?
Well, I mean, this is something that my wife and I talked about, and we had those same concerns. I mean, how do you socialize your children? So our decision was, and discussing with them, and by the way, we have a homeschool education network in our small church that we've kind of helped one another, but our decision was that we would just help them socially become more active in our church. We have some athletic programs in our church that have hundreds of school kids in it, so we decided that we would just assist them and encourage them to socialize in that circle.
Larry, great answer, and I appreciate the fact that you and your wife really thought about that. Let me rewind history, not just 50 years, but say 300 or 400 years. The rise of the public schools is itself a part of what people don't think about. The public schools emerged in the United States driven by a central ambition, not just to educate children in math and literature and all the rest, but to create a common culture, a culture that would bring together all these immigrant communities through the public schools. And now that is turned into an ambition after John Dewey and the progressivist tradition and all the rest to create an engine for influencing children and to be the kind of citizens people want them to be in the future. The problem is not just the kind of drugs and stuff that goes on in some of these schools. It's the curriculum. It's what's being taught. What do they want these children to become? That's the frightening thing in an awful lot of these settings. Let's go to Bristol, Virginia, where Stephen's on the line. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yes, I'd like to present a fifth option for schooling your children, and that would be a co-op situation where homeschoolers are getting together to collaborate on a particular curriculum, maybe a parent's proficient in higher-level math or something of that nature.
Yeah, Stephen, I really appreciate that, because that's basically what my wife and I are doing with our children, have done. With our two children, it's called a consortium, but the way it works is much like what you're describing, maybe just a little bit more formal, and then homeschooling parents got together and basically hired some teachers who are basically homeschoolers themselves but have the degrees and the preparation and the training in these things, and the kids spend a minimal amount of time in the classroom and then do the rest of the learning outside. So it's kind of a mix of the two. But I really appreciate your call. I'm glad to know something like that's going on in Bristol, Virginia. You can combine the strengths of all of this. There is something about learning in a classroom that can help kids to learn together, and there certainly is expertise and knowledge that certain people have that you want to be given to your children as well. People that have a proficiency in teaching biology and chemistry, because I can tell you right now, my wife could teach our children those things, but boy, I couldn't. Give me history and government and literature, but not chemistry. Please, I beg you. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We'll be right back.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
We're going to get to as many calls as possible. In Nashville, Tennessee, BJ's on the line. Go ahead, BJ.
Hi, my question was, just listening on the radio here, I understand my wife and I don't have any kids, and usually I'm sure a motivation for pulling kids out of a public school has a lot to do with safety and security. Because I don't have kids, I can't really understand and argue with that. But my question that I wonder about is, if we pull all the Jesus followers and the Christians out of the public school systems, then won't that just make the public schools worse, and how does that fix the problem?
That is not at all a stupid question, BJ, and it's not irrelevant, surely. That's I think, has to be a part of the thinking process of any Christian parent trying to work this through. I will tell you how I've worked through it, and just kind of offer this. Number one, my first responsibility before God is for the education of my children, not for the state of the public schools. So that is a first thing. Secondly, I am concerned for the public schools, and I am concerned with an evacuation of the public schools of all Christian families and Christian concern. I want to see Christian families there in the PTA boards and, you know, trying to do the good work. But there just comes a place where I think from time to time and from place to place, it's clear that some limit has been reached, such that it's just not possible to leave our children there in good conscience. And the influence we can have is being so countered that it's become neutralized anyway. And so, BJ, good question, and a very vital issue to be thrown out for our conversation here. Do I see the public schools as a great mission field? Yes. I think the problem is we have to understand that our children are targets of proselytization on the part of progressivist educators who want to shape their souls and minds. You know, a lot of people, I think, have their entire worldview on the public schools changed when you understand that the most powerful single influence in the public schools in the 20th century in terms of a person was John Dewey. John Dewey was the fountainhead of what was called progressivist education, and he wrote explicitly that the public schools should try to sever children from dependence upon the authority of their parents in terms of what they should think and what they should believe, and that children should basically be encouraged towards a secularized understanding of citizenship as the goal of what it means to be an American. And, you know, I just think there are a lot of Christian parents who will say, where that agenda is very far along at all, I can't leave my kids. Because, especially younger children, they're more likely to be influenced than to be influencers. So, BJ, smart question, good question, and a gospel question. But one that I think defies a really easy answer. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Lawrenceville, Georgia, where Dave's on the line. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, real quickly, our decision to homeschool was based on being around the children of other homeschoolers. When we first ran into it, we thought it was the craziest thing we ever heard of. And then we found out even these people were Christians, and we were like, oh, my word. And then we got to meet them. We got to meet these kids, and they were just dynamic. They look you in the eye when you talk to them. And so the proof is in the pudding for us. And we didn't even have children yet at the time. And so, you know, we saw that, and we kind of prayed about it. A number of years we had our children, and we started doing it, and we've never turned back. And it's been great for our family.
Now, I want to just test a theory here with you, Dave. Dave, you were educated in the public schools?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, I was too. Did your parents ever even think about this?
No. I think my mom would cringe thinking about it, but yeah. No, not at all.
Yeah, well, mine didn't either because I don't think it was on the radar screen. I don't think anyone was asking this question. You know, sending kids anywhere but the public schools was something the Catholics did, maybe, you know, sending into parochial schools, but it just wasn't on the screen. But I think as our conversation here makes clear, the world has changed.
Absolutely. And I would also put in a plug for the Homeschool Legal Defense Fund in Washington, D.C. They're very helpful in educating homeschoolers on what their rights are as homeschoolers here in the United States.
Good point, and I'm familiar with that group, and they are doing good work. And that goes back again, just take the name of that group, the Homeschool Legal Defense Fund, that there is a legal defense that is necessary because there are people who would like to remove this option as a legal option for Christian parents. I got to tell you, I think God's providence is in the fact that this movement became so large so quickly because I think had it been otherwise, those who really are convinced that children ought to be in the public schools and that that ought to be the only alternative, you might say, the only option for people, that they would have they would really have worked to make that public school monopoly a matter of law and a matter of fact. But now I'm encouraged by the fact that there's so many millions of people involved in homeschooling. I think it's going to be very difficult to put that genie back in the bottle, so to speak. I think it's going to be very, very difficult for them to remove that legal protection. But there are efforts out there. As a matter of fact, I have a document that I'm going through right now by some law professors who are suggesting this is how the argument should be made that would bring homeschooling into accountability to the public schools. In other words, if we can't legally say people can't educate their own children, we can at least say their children have to be taught these things, they have to use these books, and they have to be able to pass this test, or there will be legal consequences. We'll be tracking that kind of development as well. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. What are some clear action steps? Let me talk about churches before I get back to parents. What should churches be doing? I really want to encourage churches to take this on as an issue. At the very minimum, an evangelical church should be a place that calls parents together in order to say, where should we educate our children? How should we make these decisions? How can we support each other in making the right decision for our children? At the next level, I hope churches will think about sponsoring Christian schools. And one of the things I appreciate about our conversation today is because this whole thing of hybrids has come up. And again, our own children have been in a hybrid program, a consortium. You don't have to have a big campus and you know, a huge infrastructure to have a Christian school. Because of the fact that you can merge it or align it also combined with homeschooling, you can have minimal infrastructure, minimal bureaucracy, and minimal cost at helping to encourage that. I also hope from the pulpits of our churches is a very clear message from God's Word being presented to parents, and that is about our responsibility to teach our children. If we do not faithfully teach our children, we're falling short of one of the clearest commands in Scripture. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 6. One of the clearest commands given to anyone in Scripture is the command to parents to take responsibility for teaching our children. And of course, not just teaching them anything. The context of Deuteronomy 6 is to teach them about the one and only true God. Everything else follows from that. By this time of the year, an awful lot of parents have already made this decision. But it's the right time to talk about how we should make this decision. And out there somewhere, even right now, I'm confident there are parents who are saying, I wonder what we should do in the final analysis, even for this next academic year. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. I'm Albert Moeller.
Is the best of the Albert Moeller program.
Several years ago, about 2 years ago, I wrote an article entitled Needed an Exit Strategy. And what I was talking about is an exit strategy from the public schools. And I wrote it very carefully. I didn't say that now is the time for an exit. That is a mass call to say Christians simply must leave the public schools. You can't leave your children in the public schools. Because as I travel around this country, I am aware of the fact that even in an age of federal mandates and all the rest, there are still some big differences place to place, community to community in the public schools. And there are Christian parents in many communities who will say it's working out well for us to have our kids in these schools. I will say, as a word of analysis of what I expect, I won't say a word of prophecy, that those communities are going to get fewer and fewer all the time, and that the closer people start looking at the curriculum, the more problems are likely to find, especially as you move into older grades. And because I hear people in all kinds of places in the country say, look, we didn't have any trouble in grades 1 through 6 or 1 through 5 or 1 through 4, 1 through 3. We ran into problems later on. That's one observation kind of about where this thing stands. The other thing is that you do have not only different children of different ages and different communities, you have different genders. And I think it is really appropriate for Christian parents to realize that the educational choices we make for girls might not be the best educational choices for boys. And even in terms of homeschooling, I think most moms who have both will be the first to testify that teaching a girl and teaching a boy are often two very, very different things. Having a boy sit still and a girl sit still, having a boy write an essay and a girl write an essay, those are two very different experiences. I'm not saying boys can't be taught. We know better than that. But we do know that they have particular needs and a particular profile that means their education needs to be somewhat different than a girl's education. And the same thing's true on the other side. There are so many issues out there. I go back to the fact that this needs to be a topic of ongoing, responsible, mature Christian conversation. Christian churches need to take the lead. Christian parents need to stand up and participate in a conversation in which we as Christians talk to each other, especially as parents, about how we make these decisions and how we should make these decisions. You need to get back to the fact that the church is the new community of Christ, where in local congregations we come together to talk about the things that matter the most. And, of course, that will help us to become more faithful disciples of the Lord Jesus Christ. Good questions asked here. If abandoning the public schools means abandoning a mission field, that's a question Christians ought to talk about. That's not a slam dunk question either way. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, and I know full well, even if on some of these topics this is where we start the conversation, this isn't where it ends. Keep talking about this at home, around the dinner table, in your local church. Back next week with you for intelligent Christian conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.